What is the flipping story, everybody? Ooh, those spikes. I don't know what these. Do you know the spikes that show you the volume? They show you your voice, but on the screen, they're nice and big and chunky today. Usually they're kind of like little and small. So, looking at the output, and it's not going into red, so there shouldn't be too much unclarity going on. What is the flipping story? I was apprehensive, not apprehensive. I was just like, do I still know how to do this? About the podcast. It is 7:39 on Saturday morning. And yesterday was my 30th birthday. So I left my 20s yesterday. And what I did for my 30th birthday was I went to the beach with my girlfriend and with Sula, my dog. And we just sat on the beach and I pucked the ball with the hurley with the dog for a while. And I'm incredibly grateful for that. For the dog anyway, because Sula and basically all dogs, when you play with them, they are literally living out exactly what they want to do with their lives at that given time. It's exactly where they want to be. They don't want to be doing nothing else. They want to be chasing balls, or they want to be pulling on rags, or they want to be doing that kind of shit. That's like how they see their life going. If someone said to them, what would you like to do for the rest of your life? Say, I, you know what? I'd probably like to sleep, eat, and fetch ball. That's what Sula would say if she was able to speak. And so when I'm hitting the ball with her, I feel like I'm part of her ideal life, or her ideal day. I'm making that happen. I'm facilitating that incredible day, you know, for her. You know, she's probably not going to remember. She's not going to go, here, boys, remember that time you were out on the fucking beach and you were pucking the ball for me? That was great times, wasn't it? She's not going to say that to me. But what I have noticed in her in the last number of weeks is that she is carrying herself with a certain level of confidence. So, like, we got her, and initially when we got her, right, we had trouble getting her into the car. She wasn't scared. She was fucking terrified of getting into the car, because the last time she had gotten into the car, she was taken away from her foster family and ended up with us, people she didn't know. And so every time she was getting into the car, she was kind of afraid that, you know, we were going to leave her somewhere or someone else was going to take her away. You know, it's normal for you to feel like that as a dog who doesn't understand, you know, what's happening. You have to be shown what's kind of happening. So, like, she has gone from that dog to being a dog that, like, just jumps into the car once the door is open. You don't even have to ask her to get in anymore. She just jumps into the car straight away because she knows that, no, it doesn't end with her going off to some other family. It ends up with her going on some kind of adventure, some kind of forest walk, or to the beach to fetch the ball, or to the beach for a swim, or going for an old walk around in a riverbed. You know, it ends up with doing something fun, doing some fun shit. You know what I mean? So she's able to, you know, get into the car now, no bother. She, when we first got her, her tail used to always be tucked down really, really low, like underneath her two legs. She was very, very, you know, conscious all the time, looking around, and was very, very kind of scared. I think she wanted the world to just swallow her up sometimes. She really just, you know, she didn't feel comfortable in certain, you know, circumstances, certain situations. And now her tail is feckin' high in the air and curly and bounces as she walks. She's got a bit of that. She got a bit of a strut. She got a bit of that strut going. You know, it's amazing to see that transformation. And it really is through repetition and through living a life that leads to that, that's the way, that's why she is flourishing, because she has been put through in so many different situations, because she's involved in our life every single day. She goes where we go. So she is able to actually, you know, grow then as a dog and become more familiar with things. She wasn't great with other dogs. She wasn't great with children at the start as well. Now, fantastic. Fantastic. With other dogs, she's brilliant. She, you know, she won't take any shit, but she never ever like snaps at dogs. She never, you know, growls or anything like that at dogs. She just, you know, interacts with dogs, says hello. You know what I mean? Sniffs their ass. She gets her ass sniffed. Has a good ass time, really, you know, basically. And then when it comes to kids, she used to be like, oh Jesus Christ, am I meant to be herding these motherfuckers around the place, because they're wild and they're running around the gaff all over the place, like there's got to be some order given to this situation. So she's always thinking, am I meant to be herding these people because they're so small? Are these humans or are they something else? Are they like sheep? Because she's got collie in her, so you know she is she's got that herding instinct, you know. So she used to be like, we were bringing her down to my family home and my nephew be in the house, like, and he's not even two, and she would be herding him around the gaff, like, you know what I mean? And you know, she'd be kind of like barking at him when he moved and all this kind of stuff. Now she's flipping grand because she's used to it, you know. But anyway, that's just a little side note, because that's what I was doing my 30th birthday, really, was going, you know, spending some time with Mel and with Sula. And then I went home and I cleaned out my car, right? Do you know, this, I don't know, people I think will really, this will resonate with a lot of people, I think. You know, do you ever be driving around in your car and your car's in a state, which is the case for my car most of the time? It's just like a fucking bomb hit it, and the bomb was full of clothes and coffee cups and bottles and fucking, you know, full of like banana skins and apple cores and all different kinds of things, right? And this explosion happens and it's like I just feel okay, it's okay to drive around in the car with all of this crap inside it, right? So I said yesterday, John, I'm going to do. Because when I look at my car in that state, right, it's very, very easy to think, do you know what, my life is kind of messy at the moment. You know, I have a lot of loose ends and a lot of things to tie up. And so the car is almost like a physical representation of the mind and of the mind state that you're in sometimes. You know what I mean? So I said, do you know what I'm going to do for myself now as a treat to myself for my 30th birthday? Is I'm going to clean the car out. Like spick and span brand new. So I'm going to be like, I'm going to go absolutely hell for leather into it. I'm going to hoover every inch of it. I'm going to wipe down all the surfaces. I'm going to disinfect things. I'm going to, you know, wipe all the sills of the car and everything. Get it all done. I did it. And felt great afterwards. There are certain elements of my life that have been pulled back into the frontal view for me in the last week, which I am just astoundedly grateful for. Really and truly, I am so grateful for. And what they are, the more effort you put into your life, generally, the better your life is. That's it. That's one of the biggest things that I have learned in the last 2.5-3 years, and one of the biggest things that I have re-implemented, if you will, into my life. And it's not that we have to be fucking working ourselves to the bone all the time. It's just that the more effort that I do actually put into my life, the better I actually feel about it. Because I wasn't very good at putting effort into my life for a long time, and it led to a life where, you know, I had bouts of depression. Manic depression, really. It was like bouts of being super happy and being super sad, and not knowing how to actually navigate that and to maintain a place where I could just be a place in the middle, not on the roller coaster, but just flat on the ground, and have the ability to cope with ups and downs and with good times and bad times. You know what I mean? And have that you know, a bit, have that ability. I didn't have that. And so I didn't really put in too much effort into doing that, you know what I mean? And when I actually started to change my life, my perspective on life, and turn things around, I started putting more effort into shit, and it actually just fucking paid off, like, you know? Like, and I think that by leaving my car get into that state, number one, but and then by keeping it and leaving it and allowing it to remain in that state, number two, I was letting myself down. I was letting myself down because I don't like driving the car when it's like that. I don't like driving the car when it's super fucking messy. I like driving the car when it's fucking spick and span and it's absolutely flipping shining. And I don't like, there's a certain extent where, you know, I'd bring a car. I bought a van recently, right? And I got the van and it was an ex-council van. It's filthy, right? And I have it outside my house and I've just actually gotten insured and I'm going to getting it DOE'd and all of the bits and pieces that you need to get done in to drive it, right? And so I'm going to probably get that validated. But there is a certain joy about not getting the car validated, but actually just taking the time and effort yourself to strip out everything that you've brought into the car, right? So most of it was actually, to be honest with you, I was actually giving myself a tiny bit more of a hard time than necessary because a lot of it was just clothes. And I do use a lot of different clothing because I do sea dips, I do mountain climbing, I do mountain running, I do a lot of different activities which require me to have a lot of different things on hand at times. But there is really no excuse to not take those clothes out of the car when I'm finished with them. There's no excuse not to do that. So this is kind of such a strange little promise that I've given myself now. But my promise is that I will not let the car fall into that level of dirtiness again, of disorder again. I won't do that again. So that's a little promise I made to myself on my 30th birthday. I was like, you know what, Connor, you like when the car is clean and you've no actual problem cleaning it, but you just seem to push it to the back of your head and make it unimportant. And therefore, are you making yourself unimportant in at that time? Yeah, I am. I'm making my own, you know, my own life unimportant, and I'm just kind of trying to, you know, say that other areas are more important. And if I'm being very, very honest, something has crept into my life as well on the flip side of that, that I'm not very happy about, and that I'm actually, as of now, taking, you know, making moves to correct. And that is, I'm spending too much time on Instagram. I didn't think that I would actually spend as much time on Instagram as I thought I would, because usually my time spent on Instagram is me putting up posts, me putting up stories and that kind of thing, and then just replying to people and things like that. You know, it's not really a thing that I use to look at the world outwardly. But I do find myself flicking through reels on Instagram of late. I do find myself, you know, going on to search and, you know, seeing one of the squares that comes up and going, oh, that's interesting. And then half an hour, 40 minutes later, still swiping through or still looking at it. And it's eating into productive time in my day. And like, look, there is a place and time for all that kind of stuff. I'm going to take a sup of coffee. I'll take a sup of coffee there now. Sup of West Cork coffee that I have here, nearly a full cup. And I'm going to get that into me. It is 7:53 in the morning on Saturday morning. It's a very white sky. Very, very white, cloud-ridden sky. It's a pale white. And it's quite a subdued day, if I will. Oh, that's a good cup of Joe right there. But basically, yeah, there's time and a place for the use of social media and the use of Instagram as maybe a recreational tool, you know what I mean? No problem in sitting down and actually flicking through Instagram for a half an hour. But when it is to the detriment of other areas of your life, such as cleaning your car, such as doing your writing that you want to do, such as, you know, getting things done. I've just registered a business. I just registered business names. Getting things done to do with that is now, you know, a new concern of mine. Getting a business bank account set up, all of these different things. And so when it's taking away from that, and then you find yourself kind of giving yourself a hard time for not getting these things done, that's when it's the problem. That's when it's the problem. There's a place and time for it in all of our lives to flick through Instagram, to go on YouTube and watch YouTube videos, to do all of these different things that, you know, they are luxuries in our lives. And so I'm not saying to anybody out here, stop watching Instagram reels, stop flicking through the search engine on Instagram and looking at stuff that you're interested in. You don't have to stop doing that whatsoever. But I have just noticed in my own life that it's just to the detriment of certain things. And cleaning my car was one of those that became illuminated to me. And then we went to eat something in a pub, just proper pub grub. Had a great steak sandwich, actually. It was delicious. Only thing I'll say about the steak sandwich I got for my birthday was they brought it out uncut. The actual steak wasn't cut itself. It was resting on top of the ciabatta, right? With the mushrooms and the onions underneath and kind of untidily put on top of the ciabatta. It was like half of the onions and mushrooms were on the lower half of the one half of the ciabatta, and then like somewhere on the upper half of the other ciabatta. There was no continuity about the placement of them. And then the steak itself, although really delicious and really well cooked as far as the instructions I gave to them for cooking, very, very well cooked. It was, I usually go for rare steak when I'm having a steak, just a steak, but I go medium rare when I'm putting it in a sandwich. Don't know why I like it, but I like it that way. And so I got it right, and it wasn't cut, and I'm like, boys, you put it on top of the ciabatta, you gave me a steak knife to cut it, right? Am I supposed to take it off the ciabatta, throw it onto the cold plate, cut it, and then place it on top of it? That's something that I would say to anybody who's a restaurateur up in here, that if you give someone a steak sandwich, cut the steak. Boom. Easy. Because steak as well is one of those things where you bite it and you could have half of it still left in the sandwich, half of it in your mouth, and there's like these like strings of fat that are connecting them, and it's just a messy endeavor. It's a messy situation. Just reduce that for the customer, you know what I mean? By giving it a bit of a cut, like, you know what I mean? Just cutting it a bit up a bit, like, you know, that's all. But I loved it. It was actually really enjoyable. Chips were lovely as well. And then came home and settled into a nice evening with Mel and Sula. And honest to God, I just thoroughly enjoyed the day. Thoroughly enjoyed my 30th birthday. It was like one of those things where I realized that, you know, simplicity is paramount. By keeping things simple, it's absolutely paramount. And I just fucking enjoyed it, to be honest with you. I would have enjoyed an old pint now or something like that, but I was driving last night. Oh, we actually finished up after the pub grub. We actually went to Vartry Reservoir to do a kind of a walk that we do fairly regularly with Sula, and she fucking loves it. She loves it because it's like, do you know, like, she loves fetching the ball, she loves fetching sticks as well, and in this particular forest it's like literally you're just walking over sticks, like, you know what I mean? This is like fucking dog heaven here. Like, it's like, guys, there's 97 sticks around the place, like, do you want to throw one of them for me, like, you know? So you're just throwing sticks for her for the whole time. And then she's getting into the river in the Vartry Reservoir in the Vartry Lake. And she's loving it. Loving life. And it makes me feel good then that she's having such a good time, you know. Ooh, getting my coffee into me. You know what I mean? What are you doing right now? You who are listening to this podcast, are you you're on the way to work. Are you traveling somewhere nice to do something nice for yourself? Are you working out? You know, is this something to get you pumped? I don't know, is my voice good for getting you pumped? I think a lot of people have said to me that it helps them fall asleep. So there's a big like gap there between, you know, someone who's going to help you do a deadlift and somebody who's going to fucking let you hit the pillow, like, you know. But yeah, anyway, if you are in the gym and you are using this as a kind of a podcast to listen to in the gym, fair play. I like that now too. So basically, whatever way you want to use it or listen to the podcast, fantástico, muy bueno. Anyway, that's my fucking introduction. That's the longest introduction in the history of Flip the Script, right? That's 20 minutes long, lads. 20 minute introduction. But anyway, we got it. We got it done. We're there now. It's 7:59. You know. So this is season 2 of Flip the Script. Season 2 of Flip the Script, lads. I first of all just want to thank every single person that listened to the podcast in season 1 and everybody that become a patron of the podcast. The patronage has become something that is very, very important to me. Not just the funds that it gives to me and allows me to do the podcast and make the podcast more interesting. It is also that it has created this little miniature community that I have tried, you know, to interact with more. You know, I really have tried to interact more with the community and try to make these Patreon meetups so that everybody can connect to each other. The best thing about these Patreon meetups so far have been that people have met each other on these Patreon meetups, on these Flip the Script patron meetups, and have become friends independent of the Patreon meetup itself and independent of the Patreon, right? And they've ended up doing their own stuff, their own things, right? I'll tell you a story, right? Three guys that did not know each other before the first ever Patreon meetup, right? Three lads that didn't know each other found out that they're all interested in running. They also found out that they're all interested in trail running. They all ended up entering into the Kerryway Ultra Light, right? Three of them did. And a couple of weeks before the Kerryway Ultra Light, all three of those lads met each other and rented a property down in Kerry to do recces of the ultra with each other. That's fucking amazing. That is what I want. That is what I want to create, is that environment for people to connect and become friends, make adventure buddies, make friends, and just, you know, increase their repertoire of people that they can call upon to go and do fun shit with. Because I know a lot of people that are listening to my podcast and a lot of people that are meeting up my Patreon are people that are actually in a transition of a changing their lives, right? And they may not have that group of friends from, you know, from growing up and from college that are interested in doing that kind of stuff. And that's fair and that's okay. But they might want to broaden their horizons in terms of the friends they have, and they'll be able to get more people, you know, involved and more adventure buddies. So it's absolutely phenomenal to see, basically, guys. What I will say next is, I am incredibly lucky and I am incredibly grateful to be able to bring season 2 to you guys. What do I have in store for season 2? Season 2 is going to see the first ever guests on Flip the Script. Right, so the first ever guests on Flip the Script are going to actually happen in season 2, so I'm incredibly excited about that. I have some phenomenal guests actually already lined up. I have some phenomenal guests in mind for the future, and it really is a thing where I am just deciding, really, like, who would I like to have a chat with? It's not like I'm basing this off of, you know, who's going to get the most views and listens and who's going to help me grow my podcast by sharing it on their page or anything like that. I'm not doing it for those reasons. It doesn't matter to me, you know, necessarily the reach of the podcast. I'd love for as many people as possible to read the podcast, listen to the podcast, but I want it to be organic and I want people to listen to it because they want to listen to it. You know what I mean? So I'm not being very strategic in terms of the people that I have on the podcast. Who I'm getting on the podcast, like my parents are going to be on the podcast. Those are the two people that I've already said are going to be guests on my podcast because I just want to have a conversation with them. And I want to see if I can find out something about them that I didn't know. And also I do believe that each of our parents and each of the, you know, every person from their generation has wisdom to pass down to us, you know? Okay, you think about it now, right? You're in your 30s, right? Let's say. What wisdom will you pass down to you in your 20s? Probably a lot. Let's face it, probably a lot. When you're in your 20s, you're like, I'm not going to speak for anybody else here on this. When I was in my 20s, like my early to mid 20s, I was a stupid motherfucker. Oh my God. I thought I knew everything. So basically, I want people to, you know, I want people that are going to be able to pass down some interesting information to people as well, you know. So, yeah, that's what's going to be coming up the road for, you know, or up the road or down the road? Down the road. We'll say down the road for season two, right? But for this episode right now, I just want to go through what happened last weekend, the Kerryway Ultra, my DNF in the Kerryway Ultra. And I will go through the race. I'll go through everything up until the point that I had to pull out, and I'll go through afterwards, right? So, first of all, what is the Kerryway Ultra, right? So the Kerryway Ultra is about 190 kilometers and 5,500 meters of elevation. That's the distance and elevation of the race itself. It is grueling. It doesn't take any prisoners anyway, for sure. But it is grueling in the way that the Wicklow Way, right? I've walked quite a lot of the Wicklow Way, many, many sections of the Wicklow Way, and it is primarily good trail. Good, solid trail, forest roads. It is very, very well worn. It's the oldest walking, you know, way marked way in Ireland, right? And so it is incredibly well maintained and it is very, very well marked. And there's no real terrain that's going to give you a lot of bother. It's not a difficult or technical trail. It's long. It has a lot of elevation and it is by no means easy, but it is far easier underfoot than the Kerryway Ultra. The Kerryway Ultra at certain times really, really got me, you know, it really did. It basically led to me getting this injury that pulled me out. The injury was definitely my responsibility. I'll talk more about the injury in a minute. But anyway, so the Kerryway Ultra is that 190 kilometers, 5,500 meters of elevation. And I suppose, right, what I have tried to apply to some of my races is the mindset that I had in the 200-mile ultramarathon that I did in 2019. And that was slow and steady wins the race. Because slow and steady won the race, right? And that's okay. That's the modus operandi that I was actually working under was, okay, if I keep a slow, steady pace on this and I'm actually able to maintain this pace throughout the whole thing, I'm going to be able to do very, very well, right? That's what I had in my head. So if you were following the tracker at the very, very start, I was in the way, way, way back of the field because I started really, really slowly, really, really tentatively. I didn't want to I didn't want to just zip off at the start and then it catch up to me during the actual race itself. And I now know, looking back at that was not just that I was trying to save myself or that I was trying to, you know, that I was trying to keep my energy for later in the race. I think there was a certain element of me that didn't back myself to actually be with the lead guys. And rightfully so. I'm not where they are. I'm not where the lead guys are. The lead guys are far and beyond where I am at the moment. Which is okay. There are certain times where you actually have to realize this to actually move on and to actually get better and increase your proficiency in something. You have to realize where you are, right? Let's say you are in a, let's say something that is very, very plain to see the difference in skill levels. Like, let's say a shooting competition. Let's say you're shooting at targets, right? You think you're the absolute business at shooting, right? And you're getting fairly good scores and in training and all these things in your shooting, right? You go to a competition and lads are laying bullseyes in left, right and centre. Ladies are laying bullseyes left, right and centre. And you're there, okay, right. Maybe I am not where I thought I was in this, right? That is actually an incredibly good thing. Because if we were operating all the time under this notion that we were up with the best and we never got an opportunity to actually see where we are in terms of the best in your field, you'd never be able to actually, you know, to improve, because you'd never have anything to go off of, you know? Ooh, bit of coffee. You know, so I'm actually incredibly grateful that I actually found out. It's like someone sat down next to me and goes, ah, Connor, you're actually way off the pace. You know that? You're like, the lads are way, way, way down the line. I knew that they were going to be down the line, but I just didn't know the ferocity in which these boys were going to be able to attack this this course, you know? Like, it was actually incredible to watch, and I'm so impressed by them. Really, I am so impressed by them. But regardless of that fact, I don't think I actually felt that I was actually, I felt like maybe I would have had the mental capacity to push on, you know, when I was tired. But I didn't back myself from the beginning. And that made me slow into the first two checkpoints, really. Well, especially the first checkpoint, Brandon Cottage. Got to Brandon Cottage at the way, way back of the field, and then ended up, trying to press on between Brandon Cottage and Glen Carr and Glen Bay. And I was making up time every time, and then I started to really push it. So, like, when I left Glen Bay and then and got to Foylemore, that section I went very fast, like, you know, for me, you know, probably would have been slower than the front boys, obviously, but I went very fast for me. Got to Foylemore, felt actually great. Now, I was getting a little like, I felt like I was dehydrated. I was getting a twinge in the back of my hamstring, but it was like, I would have said to my crew, I'm perfect, like my body is perfect, because it was really perfect. My feet were perfect, didn't have a single blister. My ankles felt great, felt really strong. My knees felt really strong. My hips tighten up at the start of races, don't know why, and they start to loosen out then as they kind of warm up. They were after warming up, and the one thing was, when I was going up hills, I was getting a little twinge in my hamstring at the lower portion of my hamstring. That was the only thing I was getting. It was something I thought, I wouldn't even mention this now to the homies, because I had done 80 kilometers at that stage, basically, right? So I'd done about 73 or 4 or 5 kilometers by the time I got to Foylemore. So I was like, look, you're after doing a bit of running, so like, you're going to have something up with you, you know? Then I got my walking sticks, right, at Foylemore, right? So I had just done that section quite fast because I was very, very interested in getting to Foylemore before nightfall. Or sorry, I was getting to Waterville before nightfall, because you don't really want to be doing the Foylemore to Waterville section in the dark. And I was very conscious of that. And I think that pushed me on. If I had kept a more steady pace at the start, if I didn't go super slow at the start and have to catch up, and I kept a kind of a middle ground, I think it would have been far better for me heading off from Foylmore. But that being said, I was in fantastic spirits. I was absolutely high as a kite. I was delighted with the way things were going. I took my walking poles, took my food, and got on. Finding it hard now at this stage to get a bit of food into me, but I was trying, right? And so I started in Foylmore, and I took about seven people in the first 1,200 to 1,400 meters of that climb. Took about seven or eight people out in terms of taking them over. And this is a funny thing about what I was saying about my race. Whenever I was coming back into the checkpoint areas, I was sitting down and I was like, I'm taking people's lunch money. I'm taking people's lunch money out there. And I was just having a bit of a fun about it, having a bit of a joke with my crew and everything. I was just like, I'm taking people's lunch money. And I was like, give me your lunch money. And it's like, there's people out there and they need to give me their lunch money. They haven't given me their lunch money yet, but I'm going to get it. And I was talking like that, just having a bit of crack with the crew and, you know, kind of just having a bit of fun for myself as well, that I was taking people's lunch money as I was passing them. No, I wasn't ever making anybody feel bad when I was passing them. Always passing with an encouraging word. And I was always saying to them, here, you're probably going to catch me there now down in the checkpoint. I'll see you in the checkpoint, you know, have a good stop and keep going. Always encouraging people. This was strictly for just me and my crew, just to kind of have a bit of fun, you know. I'd never make an ultra runner or anybody that's out in the field feel bad about what they're doing or about me taking them over. That's not the way ultra works. And if I ever actually saw anybody giving somebody a hard time or anything out on the trail, like, I'd be close to laying them out, like, because it's just, you just don't do that. Like, you don't make people feel bad doing ultra marathons. Everybody's out there, and that's the thing about the ultra community. You wouldn't see it, because it's just such a positive community and everybody wants everybody to finish, that all you get and all you see is support and love and mutual respect. So it's something you don't really have to deal with. So when I'm passing, I'm always encouraging people. And I'm doing that all the way along. And I'm pushing. And I'm getting down towards Waterville. Now, the weather had been fantastic in terms of the race for weeks beforehand and on the day. That Foylmore to Waterville section, I don't think, like, the lads probably did that incredibly fast. And I don't think there'll probably be somebody to do it as fast as them, you know, for the next 10 or 15 years of the race, because it was just, the conditions were just that perfect. But that being said, got into Waterville, still felt great, had the twinge in my hamstring, and really, like, like, beyond that little twinge that was kind of pulling at me, I was feeling phenomenal. Like, I was feeling great. I was in good spirits. And I ate quite a lot of food in Waterville. Now, this is where things started to go a bit downhill for me. I left Waterville with my walking sticks, right? That was, I think, one of the biggest errors. Because I hadn't trained to run with walking sticks. And it does change your running style. It changes your running style, it changes your running gait, it changes the way you run. And so that was one of my big mistakes. I should have left my walking poles there after the Foylmore to Waterville section. Should have left them there. Should have just said, yeah, right, I've got this in my legs, which I do. I really do. I actually, you know, I think my legs are actually, you know, very well conditioned. But I didn't. I chose not to. And that was an error. And that was a mistake, and that's something that I definitely, and yet another thing I will learn from. So, number one thing that I learned was, I got to back myself from the actual very start. And I got to, if I want to actually compete, and I want to be up there, and I want to not feel like I'm rushing things, I have to be up there. I have to be up there with the top guys, if I want to be one of the top guys. Now, if I was up with the top guys in this time around, I think I probably would have had to fucking DNF far earlier in the race, because those guys were just laying down a pace that I just don't think I'd have been able to keep up with. But I'd have tried. And I was making errors in my nutrition all along the way. So my nutrition just was not where it should be. Like, the majority of things that I eat when I'm training are, I eat porridge with all types of different stuff in it, flaxseed and chia seeds and, you know, peanut butter and honey and loads of different stuff in it. I eat eggs, I eat lots of eggs, I eat vegetables, fruit, I eat, you know, I make homemade burgers and, you know, chicken dishes and all these kinds of stuff. I don't really eat a shit ton of sugar. And I was eating a lot of sugar. I was eating peanut butter and jam sandwiches with brioche buns, which were actually fairly okay. And I was eating sugar, I was eating macaroons, I was just not really fueling myself the way that I should have been doing so. And I ate a lot in Waterville. And then I caught up with a friend of mine outside of Waterville. And I think I pushed on a bit too hard coming out of Waterville. I think he was in a better nick than me, better physical condition than I was, you know, better running condition for sure than I was. And I kept with him because I just made that decision. I said, okay, two heads are better than one kind of type deal, right? And so I feel like I didn't give my body the time to digest food. It was starting to really kind of turn to shit on me. And from that section, so it's about 11 kilometers, I think I actually couldn't be 100% sure. It could be 500 or 600 meters off or a kilometer off, but I think it's about 11 kilometers from Waterville to Caherdaniel, right? And in that section, I didn't take a sup of water. I didn't eat a morsel of food. I didn't do anything, really. Nothing got into my stomach. And that was the beginning of it, really, like, you know. And then we had Caherdaniel to Sneem. And I was, yet again, with my buddy, who was in far better condition than I was. In terms of his fitness, both of us were in kind of the same physical state in terms of after running and stuff, but he was in far better fitness than I was. Basically, he was fitter. And, you know, that was yet another wake up call, you know, I'm way off the pace. I'm way off the pace of what I thought I was. And it's very, very humbling. It's incredibly enlightening. It's enlightening to take that view. You know, to just be 100% honest and look at myself in the mirror and go, you're not where you need to be. And that's okay. It's not like I'm being hard on myself saying, Connor, you're fucking useless. I'm saying, no, Connor, you actually have the ability to be where you want to be, but you're just not there yet. And that's something that's really good to understand and really good to find out, is that you need more work. You know, and it's maybe not even that you need more work, but maybe you need to refine what you do and you need to become better at it and be more productive with the time you have, right? So I wasn't in the condition that he was in. I was trying to keep up with him, basically. When at that point, leaving Caherdaniel, I really should have said, man, you're running an incredible race here. Like, you're really running a great pace. You know, I'm only slowing you down. You know, I wasn't feeling great after leaving Waterville in terms of my diet. You know, I started to get kind of sick in my mouth. Sorry for anybody who's eating dinner or something right now, but I wasn't feeling good stomach-wise, which is okay. I was expecting that and I could get through it, you know, and I knew that I was going to be able to pull through that element, but I ended up just trying to keep with him, and where I should have said, look, just push on and just go, you know, go for it. But I didn't. Got into Sneem. By the time I got to Sneem, my hamstring twinge was now something that was kind of concerning me. I was finding it hard to lift my leg. I was finding it hard to, I couldn't straighten my leg really anymore. And it was really starting to become an issue for me. So I got to Sneem, and at Sneem I said, the friend that I was running with is Stephen Murphy, who has only run one ultra marathon before this, and it was a 12-hour race. He did phenomenally in that. He finished far above me in that as well. I don't know, was it 6th or 70 he got in that race? I finished 9th. absolutely incredible runner, and I felt like I'm just like, Steve, I'm letting you down here now. If I allow you to stay with me, you need to press on, you need to push forward. So that's what, and that's exactly what he did. So he left then from Sneem. When we left Sneem, where did we go to Sneem? Oh yeah, Sneem to Temple No. That was that was not good. That was not a good section for me. Sneem to Temple No is an incredibly tough section in terms of the footing and in terms of the ground. It's very uneven, it's very wet, damp, slippy, and it's just not what you want when your leg is starting to kind of, your leg is starting to lock up, really. Like, you know, I've had injuries, many injuries. Like, I've had really, really bad injuries that stopped me from running, but I could still walk. This one was just, like, I was screaming in pain in the middle of the forest. Like, I would extend it that bit too much. And it was like, I'm very good at dealing with pain. It was like someone just shot me in the fucking leg. Like, honest to God, I was letting off screams like, oh, fuck, in the middle of the forest, like pitch black. Nobody around. No one around. And just me fucking screaming. Honest to God, it was like, whatever was happening to my hamstring, this is the way that I describe it, right? It's like there was a, let's say there's a rope attached to my heel, and the other attachment is in my ass, and this rope is under my skin. And it felt like somebody had put something behind my knee, had inserted something behind my knee, and was now twisting the rope so that it was getting tighter and tighter. So my heel and my ass were starting to get closer to each other. It felt like that. I felt like I was losing mobility with it. At every kilometer that ticked on by, I was losing mobility. And so by the time I got to Temple No, my leg was just not at all in good nick. I got lost for about a kilometer and a half, had to kind of backtrack around. I also got lost in one section, in one particular section. I think it was from Temple No to Kenmare, maybe. Or is it Kenmare? Or was it to Temple No? One of those two sections I got lost. I basically, my watch was telling me where to go, and my watch told me to go through some ditches, to go through some gorse, and I ended up just like basically just fucking flowing around in the middle of some gorse for ages. I was like, what the fuck? Like, I was getting prickled and fucking falling into ditches and all types of stuff. And my leg was in really bad way. And then coming into from Temple No to Kenmare, in Temple No you spend about 4 kilometers maybe on a road, just kind of going down the roadway, and that was fairly okay. I was actually fucking grand with the road. And then you turn up into a forest, and yeah, then it just started to go really, really downhill. I couldn't really lift my leg very, very well. My leg was like just fucked, really, like, you know, and my stomach was in shit. I was falling asleep because I had just hadn't been able to get any food or water into me really for the last 10 hours. And I made the final climb up and down into Kenmare, and the last 2.5 kilometers going into Kenmare took me 1 hour and 45 minutes plus. That's how fucked my leg was. It was a case of like many times where I was actually like sitting down on the side of rocks to try and like swing my legs around so that I didn't actually have to try and straighten out my leg. Because I'd scream in pain, you know, when it happened. And then coming down into Kenmare, I hit some road again, which was okay for my leg. I didn't have to straighten it very much. I still had my walking poles. Still had my fucking walking poles, which I do think was a big mistake on my part. That was my decision to keep them for that long, and I really shouldn't have had them. So I got into Kenmare, and this is when I made the decision really that was going to put the final nail in the coffin. I said to the lads, I said, do you know what I'll do? I'll actually hop into the back of this van and I'll sleep for half an hour. And if I sleep for half an hour, maybe my stomach will, you know, will settle down and I'll be able to get a bit going again. And I never really thought about the leg. I thought, oh, well, look, it's a sore leg. You know, I never really thought that it was going to get any worse by going for a sleep. But I hopped in anyway into the back and my dad said, look, I'm putting a timer on for 40 minutes. So you can have a sleep there for, it might take you 5 or 10 minutes to get to sleep. I'll give you half an hour. Said, grand. Next thing I know, I'm, you know, the fucking van door is swinging open and I'm being told to get fucking going and didn't have a fucking clue where I was or what I was doing. But anyway, I got the shoes on and got out of the van. Holy shit. I couldn't stand on the leg. The leg in that half an hour had just completely locked up. The body wants to keep us safe. Right, the body wants to keep us safe, and so like when you have a tight back or tight hips or anything like that, it's the body is tightening those things up so you can't move in certain ways anymore so that you can't pull muscles. And that's why, you know, when you see people and they make a sudden jerking motion, that's that their body has moved into a movement pattern that their body isn't allowing them to do anymore. And that's why they end up pulling a muscle and end up getting hurt. And that's what your body does. It tightens things up. And it tightened up my leg to the point where I couldn't straighten it. Like straightening it was out of the question anyway. Regardless of what was going to happen, straightening it was out of the question. I whatever was pulling on my hamstring at the beginning was pulling right at the back of my knee. And I'm feeling it right now as I'm talking to you. I'm feeling behind the back of my knee. And there's like these thick kind of ropey muscles there that are still really tender to touch. I don't know what happened. I honestly don't know what happened. All I know is that because I'm still feeling the injury today, I'm still not able to run. I'm still actually finding trouble, you know, going for a long walk. When I mean long walk, no, I mean something that's over 5 kilometers. I'm still finding it tough to do that now, and we're, you know, a week on. One, I made the right call. I made the right call in doing that because, you know, I could have really, really, really damaged it. It's at the point now where I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm going to probably either have to get an MRI or I'm going to have to get a physio or multiple physios. I'll get my coach, Donica, Fit for Long, to have a look at it anyway, for sure. And it's always good to get second opinions on all these different types of things anyway. But I will have to, you know, investigate it before I get back into a training regime. And what surprised me most about, you know, basically, there's a certain thing where you could, you know, ask me the question, do you think I could have made it to the end? Could I have made it to the end? That's a tough question. I honestly think I wouldn't have actually made it in time. I don't think I'd have made it with the cutoff. It took me an hour and 45 minutes to do 2.5 kilometers, right? Actually took me, well, closer to 2 hours to do 2.5K. That's the level that I was working on. This was before I went to sleep, right? When I woke up, I think I was about 26 hours into it or something like that at that stage. If I had tried to do it, there's no way I would have covered 26 kilometers in 14 hours. And it seems astounding to think about it in that way and to think that, no, you wouldn't have been able to. But there's just the way my leg was, there was no way I was going to finish. And regardless to that, that's not the stage that I want to, that I'm in at the moment in my ultra career. It's not just about finishing, really. You know, it's about more than that. And it's also a huge consideration to me at that time was Project 32, which is meant to be starting at the start of November. And being fit and healthy to do that and train for that, because I have to train very, very hard from now to then to kind of re-sculpt my body to carry the weight for that long period of time. So that was a huge concern of mine. So with all of those things taken into consideration, I definitely made the right call. And then as I sat there afterwards, it's so weird, you know, you think about something like a DNF or having to be pulled out of a race as like, you know, a nightmare, as something that would just be soul destroying and soul crushing, and you'd never be able to recover from it. And that's one of those things where, you know, that type of thought pattern has driven me at certain points in time in ultramarathons. It's driven me. You don't want to fucking have to deal with this failure. Like that's, and that is just going completely against what you think about failure and what you have said about, because the reason why I got this hypothesis about failure is because thinking back on my past failures in my life has illuminated some of the greatest realizations that I've ever had in my life. I've had huge failings in Thai boxing, in relationships, in my career, in everything. I've had huge failings. And since I had changed my life around a bit in terms of living it more positively and, you know, getting more involved with ultramarathon and all of these things, I hadn't really had much failure. I almost had the Midas touch. I had the Midas touch. Everything was turning to gold, you know? And I had never had to deal with a failure face to face, you know? And now I was dealing with that. Now I was dealing with this failure, and I'm thinking, okay, this is meant to be soul destroying. You know, this is meant to be soul destroying, because I'm thinking back on the past failures. On the past failures when I really didn't have self-esteem. I didn't have any positive view of myself at all. And I'm thinking, okay, every time I failed in the Thai boxing arena, let's say, I felt incredibly low for months, if not years. You know, the time that I was knocked unconscious for that Irish title fight, it took me years. It took me honestly years to compartmentalize that, to go through it, to forgive myself and to move forward from it. And so I felt like, okay, if I do this and I fail in this ultramarathon, am I going to be in that situation again? And am I going to be thinking, you know, I'm not going to be able to fucking recover from this, right? But when I made the call to pull out of the race, I was incredibly calm. I was incredibly calm. I was assured. And it was probably because I had the knowledge that there is absolutely no way, if I could have seen myself finishing that race within the time limit, there's absolutely no way that I'd have actually let this slip. But I made the right call, I made that decision, which is a very, very tough decision for anyone to make, to pull out. It's a very, very tough decision for not just me, for anybody that has made that decision to DNF and has made that decision to make that call. Because I think one of the big questions that people are left with when they pull out of those races is, could I have fucking done it? Could I have continued? Could I have made it? Could I have actually just fucking gritted and went and did it? And when you answer that question and it's a no, you're actually able to kind of go, right, okay, I made the right call here. And it's like, it's not just about the race. We live to fight another day. And what I have learned about this failure is that a failure is a very, very small price to pay to find out that you were actually always the person you thought you were. And the person I thought I was somebody who was mentally tough to take failures and successes. And the thing about failures are they are different to successes in the way that they are processed. A success is a shared experience. You know, you share a success. Like me and my father would hug and, you know, had our time together when I crossed the line of the 200 mile marathon, and everybody is patting your back, and, you know, I was greeted home to congratulations banner by my mother, and, you know, everybody shares in that victory with you. When you fail, it has to be shouldered alone, and it has to be carried by you. And it is entirely up to you how you carry it. It's entirely up to you how you carry it. And if you decide and you make that decision in your mind that you're going to carry it forward, to use it to become better, to have a more positive output in your life, and for it to actually, you know, improve your life, that is... Come on, if there's anybody that's listening that is actually able to do that, it's so commendable. I am doing it. I'm trying to do it, and I'm continuing to do it. I'm trying to really look at it honestly and give myself every single possible angle as to, you know, how improvements can be made. But also, it has illuminated to me that it is not just the race that I am responsible for, it is the process. It's the process leading up to anything that I do, not just the race, and afterwards. And the good thing about ultramarathon for me has always been that the ultramarathon itself is only a small part of my life and a small part of what makes up who I am. And so this really was, when I finished up this race, was a contemplation of life. Not really just a contemplation of the Kerryway Ultra. Because, you know, I know there are people that will have finished that race and they'd have gotten a good position in that race and all of this kind of stuff. And you know what? It's terrible to say it. They're going to feel bad. They're going to feel bad afterwards because they haven't dealt with the process. They haven't been in the process. They are merely living for that event, or they're living for that race. They're living for that finish line, that start line, that process of actually doing the race. They're living for that. And there are people that are not going to be happy almost regardless of how they do in the race itself. But one thing that I said after I won the 200 mile race in 2019 was, I don't feel any different. I don't feel any different. And that is one of the most beautiful things that I have actually ever felt in my life. Was after a huge victory, I didn't feel any different because I already felt like I was worthwhile. Like I was worth something, like that I was a good person, and that I was giving myself every opportunity to have a good life. And the same thing goes after this ultramarathon. On the inside, where it matters deep down inside my being, I don't feel any different. I don't feel any different because I'm still a good person. I'm still putting one foot in front of the other, and I'm still doing the things that make my life worthwhile. And that's a blessing. And to anybody that is out there in which, you know, is chasing down that external validation and is trying to find, you know, some semblance of themselves within that external validation, you are enough. You are enough already. You don't need the medals and all of these things. And hey, look, I'm not for one second saying that I'm not going to try and win this Kerryway Ultra. Love to. I'd absolutely love to. I will make every single possible decision and, you know, take every possible path that will lead to that. Because I feel like that would be, you know, that would be an expression of how I'm feeling. How I'm feeling already about my life and about myself. It'd be a huge expression to do that and to have that, you know, to have that feeling. So I am not for one second saying that I'm not trying to win Kerryway, and I'm not for one second saying that trying to win races is not a good endeavor. It is absolutely beautiful. It's wonderful. And I'm sure that all of the lads that finished even inside in the top 5, top 10, or even finished the race felt phenomenal. But I know that there is going to be certain people that will not feel the way they thought they might have felt. Because I've been there before. They don't feel like they have, you know, done what they wanted to do, or whatever the case may be. They might just feel this overbearing sense of kind of negativity, or, you know, an inability to get themselves forward. And I just want to say to you guys that you're enough regardless of the race. You know what I mean? Or regardless of anything. Regardless of how well your career is going. Regardless of your relationships. Regardless of what car you drive. Regardless of where you live. Regardless of what size your house is. Regardless of anything. You are enough. You are worthwhile. And we just have to see that. We have to see that within ourselves. And in that way, we can take the slings and the arrows of the world. We can take on anything. We can take on any disappointment, any failure, any success, any beauty. Anything in life, we can take it on if we truly do believe in ourselves that we are worth it, that we are worthwhile, that we are, you know, that we are enough. Regardless of anything, it doesn't have to say Gucci on your shoes. Doesn't have to say, and it can say Gucci on your shoes. I don't mind. It's not like I'm saying nobody buy labels or anything like that. It's fantastic. If you feel like with or without these Gucci shoes, I'm Gucci myself. I'm actually Gucci without the Gucci shoes. With or without it, you are who you are. And look, you're not going to change. You have to be you. You have to be comfortable in you, and you have to sit inside in who you are. And that's the process that I am in right now. Regardless of what happens in my external life, I know that I am always operating under the information that I have been given to myself. I am operating with the best intentions for myself at that time. And so it makes it easier for me to forgive myself for mistakes and to learn from them. Not to hold on to them. I've held on to mistakes and errors and misjudgments in my life for way, way, way too long. And the reason that being is because I felt like I was the architect of my own destruction at that time in my life. And right now, I do not feel like that. I feel like I am the architect of whatever I want to bring into my life. And you know what? I'm doing a pretty fucking good job. I have been doing a pretty good fucking job. And this is a minor setback in one area of my life, but an incredibly necessary one. Not just to illuminate mistakes or possible ways that I can improve in ultramarathon, but in life itself. My failing in my ultramarathon is what got me to clean my car yesterday. And that's a very, very profound point. It seems very, very simple, but it's a very profound point. And the point is that this shortcoming in this ultramarathon has reminded me that I must put effort into my life, and I must put effort into my day if I want to actually live the way I want to live. So when your ultra marathon setback gets you to clean your car, what that means is you have received a perspective change from this failure or setback that is going to positively impact many other areas of your life. If you are strong enough to let that happen, if you are strong enough to see it in that way, and you are strong enough to actually say, okay, we have the ability to change and we have the ability to affect our lives positively through the eyes of this setback or this misfortune. My God, you have so much power. You have so much power within you right now to decide what way you're going to actually take anything in your life, up or down. Let's all remind ourselves that we are always enough, you know what I'm saying? Excuse me. It is 8:49 on Saturday morning, and you know what, actually? There is meant to be somebody coming to drill a new well for the house. Our well dried up, lads and ladies. Our well dried up outside. We didn't have any drinking water. We still don't have any drinking water for the last couple of days. We've been drinking out of, we had to get drums of water in. And there is somebody apparently coming in the next 10 minutes to start drilling a new well, right? So there could be some noises out the front. But I'm very, very conscious that I want to leave this on a more lighter note, you know? I do want to leave it on a more lighter note, and I don't want to, I don't want to leave it on a kind of a note of, well, do you know what? It's a positive note that I'm leaving it on, but I want to leave it on a more of a note where I might leave it a bit of a smile on our face. And I just want to let everybody know that the Kerry Way took my lunch money. After all of my talk about taking people's lunch money, my lunch money actually started to get took as I was going around again. So like, people that I had passed out earlier in the race were now passing me out and taking my lunch money. I was absolutely poor by the end of it because everybody was taking my lunch money. And in the end, in Kenmare, the Kerry Way Ultra took my fucking lunch money. And you know what? It's up to me to go get it back. So, on that note, let's all treat each other and treat ourselves with respect and compassion, and have gratitude for our days, and have gratitude for the things that we are able to utilize within our days and utilize within our lives, and the things that are really important to us. And when we simplify things, we really do see the big picture, and we see and we realize what's important to us in our lives. So respect yourself, be compassionate to yourself, and as always, I'm going to leave you with peace and with love. Con.